Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens, right here on Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon. You are with Reality Check Radio with Marie and Marty because it is Media Matters time on a Thursday. I'm getting used to the new day, Marty. I'm getting there. I'm getting in the groove of a Thursday afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am good. Well, I'm surviving now. We had a bit of a cold snap through here. Thunder and lightning, very, very exciting. Snow.
Chilly. Yeah, no, it's good. You can certainly feel it.
No, what is chilly, though, is some of the opinions in the newspaper for certain people, and certainly things are heating up in other areas as well. There was a lot of wah-wahing, fawning, complaining, because it looks like equality is starting to creep back into discourse in New Zealand, and equity may be on the way out, and some are not happy about it.
Yeah, actually, just this morning happened to watch an interesting lecture from PragerU on the ongoing project of Maoism and how the key thing that he did was really pitted himself and his followers against anyone else and portrayed them as being anti-national and so on. The commentator drew a parallel with, you know, anyone who was against what the government was doing in the space of COVID, for instance, was against the people. And anyone who's a climate change denier is against the people. And we're seeing that. And I've thought a lot about that oppositional kind of, which does come to us from the Westminster system, doesn't it? Since the government and His Majesty's loyal opposition. It's a very chessboard way of looking at things. And I think it's been interesting, this talk of kotahitanga lately. And I guess this leads on from the point or the quote I made from the guy who wrote Nature Boy. You know, it's not really black against white. It's the lovers against the haters. And so, you know, I've been thinking a bit about what we lovers have got to do to engender this kotahitanga, this togetherness. And it's not to say that there's not a great place for oppositional thinking, you know, the devil's advocate, or I always enjoy Edward de Bono's, I think it's six thinking hats. Yep. One of them's the black hat, where you talk about everything that can go wrong. But we're kind of stuck in black hat thinking. Black hat and yellow, sort of, I think it's yellow, the blue sky of the government and the black hat of the opposition.
And also, too, we have been groomed, this whole be kind, we have been groomed for such a long time now, for years, that we are not allowed to have a robust oppositional conversation in any sphere. So you're not allowed to question the government, you're not allowed to question those in authority, you're not allowed to question even conversations with those around you. And if you do, it's not a to and fro, it is a complete polarization of one side versus the other. As you said, the lovers versus the haters. But this is the problem. The haters think they're the lovers.
And there's something that's been substituted like a poison for true adversarial arguing. And so if you ask a school kid, okay, give me an argument against anthropogenic climate change, they won't be able to do it, because the way they're taught, there's either people who want to fight against climate change, as stupid as that sounds, and people who are, you know, basically funded by the coal industry who hate nature.
Yeah. And also they are taught that a statement is an argument.
Yeah.
It's not an argument.
Yeah, there are people who want to toi tu te tiriti, you want to leave the treaty undisturbed, even though it's the principles that disturbed it. And there are people who hate Māori. So there's a whole series of straw man arguments. So it's kind of bringing back some actual arguments rather than ad hominems. And there's a lot of ad hominems. If you play on Twitter, as I have, whew, there's some poison in there.
You're loving being back, aren't you, on the X?
Yeah, I do quite enjoy it. Now and then you do run into some poisonous people who use poisonous techniques, who, you know, misrepresent or really sort of, you know, represent what you're saying in a really ugly way that they know is not true. And they just try and stink it out. stink out the discussion. And it's tough to know what to do with that because I'm loath to block people. But I think it's probably better because whether you like to admit it or not, it is a grind dealing with lunacy and it's amazing how people in that more government, less freedom space, for all that they, do talk about kindness, as you say, it's tough not to characterize them as evil.
So
if you want to find me on Twitter, I'm Marty Gibson at Marty Ozone. So give me a follow. Let's have a chat.
There you go. I'm on there too, but I'm the world's greatest voyeur.
Yeah, you're not going to find out what Busky's handle is.
No. Well, no. Mine's actually Mac Busky. It's quite easy. But social media and I have a love-hate relationship.
Yeah, well, you've been hammered a lot more than I have, haven't you? I mean, you've had – and because you're a big girl and, I'll rephrase that, Busky.
No, well, I am a big girl, so that's okay. So that's
you know what I mean. Though. You come across as very contained and resilient, but you've got a sensitive heart. Like all people who aren't psychopaths, if someone's saying something, even if it's patently false, there's a moment where you consider it, and in that time, you can sustain hurt, and they know it, and that's why That's why they do it. They want to stink out the forum.
And having lived through a couple of rather large social media pylons where it literally feels like thousands of people are screaming at you and saying the most vile, awful things, it is, yeah. So as I said, social media and I have a love-hate relationship, but it is okay. I am actually quietly lurking around in the corners, which doesn't worry me quite so much. I can see what is going on. In terms of the papers, though, over the weekend and into the week, I found this really interesting juxtaposition between some equality starting to come back in. And one of the things, and they only just touched on it in a few places, is that the government is starting, or they're rolling back one of the promises that they had to drop the race-based criteria in terms of awarding contracts. And I remember when this was rolled out, they had this system where they needed to award contracts, I think it was 8% to Māori businesses, and you had to identify if you're a Māori business and all of these different things, and they're now rolling that back. New Zealand First wanted it, ACT wanted it. It is now beginning to happen. And both Anna White in the Post and Jamie Ensor in the Weekend Herald discussed this. And of course, again, they start panicking because they believe by doing this that there is going to now be an uneven balance on who gets these contracts awarded. And let me just get the paper.
Yeah, you can either be for race-based funding or you're a racist. No, I never got that one. You can either be for race-based funding or you want to see Māori health continue to decline when it's actually getting better and better. But
And we'll actually get onto that a little bit in a minute because you pulled up a great article that sort of takes all of those statements and pulls it to pieces in another area. But anyway, I just want to talk about this one in the Post. Government says public service must prioritise the needs of all New Zealanders. Anna White, Cabinet has instructed public service organisations to prioritise the needs of all New Zealanders and removed the target of 8% of government agencies' yearly contracts that go to Māori businesses. Public Service Minister Nicola Willis said the move would ensure that they were awarding government contracts on the basis of public value. Stop it. They're spending our money wisely, Marty.
I mean, these discussions are happening. I saw on Tucker Carlson someone, and I've got that thing that you get when you watch podcasts and it's not as easy to index it as when you read books. But he said, if you really wanted to address the number of people killed with guns in America, the first place you'd look is where the majority of them are, which is white men shooting themselves. But they don't do that.
No, they don't. And they got comment from David Seymour, ACT leader. Seymour says colourblind public service would be better at eliminating hardships. As an example, the new approach means the public sector can't simply assume Māori have shorter life expectancy because they are Māori, as Jacinda Ardern once infamously said. Instead, they must drill into the data and ask, is this related to rural living? Is it to do with poor housing or other known factors? That is a very, very good point, because I know that when it comes to healthcare and other aspects, they'll often never drill down. They'll only ever go to, oh, we need to concentrate on our most vulnerable. Remember that word? Sorry to trigger everybody, vulnerable. And what often defined vulnerable was just a flat racial label at the top. But they never drill down into things like, were you living rurally or urban? What was your household income? What was the housing quality like? Is there a father in the home?
Yeah, and that's one they never going to drill down into that.
No.
But also, there is that not enough to go around. So why give people who don't need things money when you'd be better off giving that money to people who really need assistance from the government? Again, on Twitter, remember someone had said that, some Maori leader had pointed out, you know, that Maori had greater needs and therefore needed earmarked funding. And I just said, do you need more assistance from the government? And you know, silence. Because they don't.
No, they don't. However, the Green Party spokesman for public service, Francisco Hernandez, said the government's moral compass has quite clearly gone missing. The reality is that need and race are intertwined. Failing to acknowledge the structural racism that plagues our communities will see it only get worse while needs remain unmet. This is nothing more than a dog whistle and a distraction from the government's failure to address the critical issues that we're all facing as a country. Yes, comrade.
Yeah, like structural racism isn't a dog whistle to all the graduates.
I know. Pretty much. Anywho, this is the thing that does drive me a little bit crazy, is because the one thing I will give this coalition government, and I don't see many articles around this, is they had a coalition agreement. They'd cobble this agreement together between three parties. Everybody had very, very clear ideas of what they wanted and where they wanted to go with it. But no one is actually going through and doing a checklist of everything on that agreement. And I have to say, from what I've seen so far, they've been pretty methodical going through that coalition agreement. Here's the agreement. This is everything that we're planning to do. This is what we want to have happen. This is what we're starting to actually achieve.
Yeah. Well, the polling is what's happening. They're polling Kiwis, and the majority of them are saying, yeah, carry on doing what you're doing. And so what they're figuring is, well, Labor are going to whine, the newspaper are going to support more government, less freedom initiatives. So we just have to run the gauntlet. And, you know, as Christopher Luxon said, I'm sick of the talk. I want to get on with doing things. And I hope they do. I do think they could sell, as I always say, could sell things better. And that would maybe make it easier for them. But and maybe get them more support so we're not in danger of getting little Chrissy Hipkins back.
Well, and it doesn't help as well that when you've got, as you said, a media that isn't necessarily helping, but also too when you've got a sector of the electorate, like as you mentioned before, there was a dog whistle in there when they said structural racism, there is still a sector of the electorate out there at the moment that believe in these really pernicious critical social justice ideas. And that was summed up beautifully. And I know you didn't read it because you sort of, I think, saw it and thought, that's 10 minutes of my time I'm never going to get back. But there was an article in the Sunday Star Times. Of course it was in the Sunday Star Times.
Lucky Star Times.
The Sunday Star Times. Honestly, The eye rolling was strong on this one. Sunday Star Times, sister's DNA test leads to apology for slavery in West Indies. So straight away, my hackles went up. Kate Thomas and Aidy Walcombe want New Zealanders to reflect on how the country was colonised with fortunes made from the transatlantic slave trade. Kate Thomas and Aidy Walcombe have returned from Jamaica, where they made a public apology on behalf of their family. Who on earth in their family, for starters, gave them the authority to go and do this? I mean, anyway, indulgent much. The sisters made the emotional apology to people of Jamaica on the behalf of the clan Malcolm of Argyle, who owned and ran sugar plantations and estates. Thomas, who works in the social impact sector, what on earth is that, Martin? The social impact sector. And the sister, who was an actor and director, who is currently featuring on Celebrity Treasure Island. I know. I won't go on because I just know that this is going
to. That's why I need it.
Exactly. The audacity the audacity to believe that your apology is going to affect change or is meaningful in any way, shape or form. The only thing that this is meaningful is to your overinflated social egos, darlings.
Yeah, your little career. And I did read the one over the page, reparations set to top list of topics for CHOGM, Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. So, yeah, apparently Africans want reparations for slavery. And I thought they were meaning they wanted to repay black people in America for having sold them. But no, they want more money. It's like double dipping. The thing that always annoys me is that Britain, it's a pretty good argument to be made that Britain lost more money from slavery than they gained because they spent so much and lost so many lives fighting it.
Yeah.
And they determinedly eliminated it. And I often say, you know, New Zealand needs to deal with our legacy of slavery, which we're not that worried about. But you can see all the time as Māori leaders treat and talk about non-Māori taxpayers like they're slaves, you know, people that you can take resources from without reciprocity, and you can denigrate their whakapapa on the basis of some past utuhu. And,
yeah. If you want to look more into that, I mean, no one's written about this more than Douglas Murray, and he dedicates quite a bit to it in his book, The Madness of Crowds. He has an entire section on racism there, and then he also touches it on it again in The War in the West. Murray said, on the topic of reparations, Murray said, if we want to play this fairly, we should at least look at all the countries around the world that engaged in the slave trade who were simply not interested in any form of reparations. Explaining why he thought the debate about reparations was targeted at Britain and America, Murray added, it's not because we're racist, it's because we're better, it's because we're good, it's because when we see racism, we actually call it out and recognize it as sin. And that's just it. Slavery is still going on today. I look at this in the reparations. Well, where are the reparations for those child trafficking?
Slave comes from the word Slav, and Arab countries and the Turkish Ottoman Empire stole 1 million people out of there. They stole hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people from around the Mediterranean and around Ireland, all those coastal castles you see. And even more obscene is the slavery still going on today.
Mm.
And, I mean, with the Jamaica thing, the number of Irish who were taken to Jamaica to be essentially slaves, maybe they should go and apologize to them next. Nah,
yes. Right. I know. But let's pivot then slightly, since we're in a slightly crabby ish mood. You sent me a piece from the New York Post, and what I loved about it was it was a really good checklist of things that are said and what we're led to believe in the media, which is, of course,
such a nice contrast with just the Chinese water torture of climate stories that even now falsifiable and are always presented without, as I said, that opposing argument.
So this was by Bjorn Lomborg, and I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of Bjorn, and he has been one of the ones that has really pushed back on a lot of these climate hysterical type stories. He's been a real sort of warrior in this space.
Yeah, well, he wrote that book, How to Spend, I can't remember how many billion dollars it was, and he was reviewing various aims of the UN, and climate change didn't even make the top 20. He for the first time really analyzed the spending, analyzed the benefits of doing that, and climate not so much.
No,
TB or malaria was, I think, the number one.
So this is from the New York Post, September 15th, so pretty recent. It's called Shrinking Island, Vanishing Polar Bears, the Climate Scare Stories That Turned Out to Be False. And there's quite a litany of them.
Yeah, well, those ones that you just mysteriously stop hearing about, and polar bears were certainly one of those. The reason you stopped hearing so much about them, although they did still appear in protest, was that the global polar bear population has increased substantially from 12,000 in the 1960s to around 26,000 in the present day. And the main reason is that people are hunting a lot less of them. And, you know, the other one was Australia's Great Barrier Reef, The latest official statistics show a completely different picture from the coral bleaching and loss that the campaigners were worried about. And it's showing now that for the past 3 years, the Great Barrier Reef has had more coral cover than at any point since records began in 1985, with 2024 setting a new record. You don't get that headline, do you?
No. And the other one, too, is 2019, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres flew all the way to Tuvalu for a Time magazine cover shoot. Wearing a suit, he stood up to his thighs in water, demonstrating our sinking planet. The accompanying article warned the island and others like it would be struck off the map entirely by rising sea levels. This summer, New York Times finally shared what it called a surprising climate news. Almost all atoll islands are increasing in size. In fact, the scientific literature has documented this trend for more than a decade. While rising sea levels do erode land, additional sand from old coral is washing up on low-lying shores. Extensive studies have long shown this accretion is stronger than climate-caused erosion, meaning the land area of Tuvalu is increasing. Climate change is real. It is man-made. It is a challenge that needs more sensible policies. But campaigners do the cause a massive disservice by refusing to acknowledge evidence that challenges their intensely doom-ridden worldview. You know, it was the other interesting, my little trip to Wellington the other week, the Assistant High Commissioner for Samoa was speaking to the student CHOGM, because of course CHOGM is going to be in Samoa, talking about all the things that how important it was to have this in a Pacific nation, the help that they received from New Zealand and other nations, bigger their bigger friends and partners in the region to actually make this, to achieve it. And then she got on to around the importance of the conversations that would be held, like threats to island nations such as Samoa and climate change, and then cited, I think it was the 2009 tsunami.
Yeah, you don't need to. You know, the bit just after you stopped reading with that was all these misguided claims add up and have shaped the climate panic that has led to politicians passing climate legislation that now costs the world more than $2 trillion annually for a tiny benefit. Now, the question we've got to ask is who gets that $2 trillion? Who gets our, you know, whether we use 14 billion this decade or 70 billion, as I'm more inclined to believe.
Yep.
Who gets that? And are those people who get it the same ones that own the media that's reporting the climate hysteria?
In the short term. But also, did you see the article that was, and I've just got to find it now.
I've passed it on to the Greenwashed team. There's a good article by Kate Ackland, who is Beef and Lamb New Zealand's chair and a mid-Canterbury sheep, beef and dairy farmer. This was in Sunday Star Times business section. And she was talking about how the freshwater rules unscientific and unrealistic and seem designed to destroy sheep and beef farming. Some national models suggest that even if all agriculture ceased and developed catchments were reverted back to the natural state, up to 38% of rivers could not meet those bottom lines. I'll leave that, but watch out on Greenwashed for that, because they said she's on their radar, and hopefully they have a good chat to her. She made some good points in that article.
Sorry, I've just got to find this, because what I'm looking for ties in exactly to what you've just said.
Oh, Russell, Russell, Russell.
I'm sure it was in the Saturday Herald. Let's have a little look.
Give me a clue, Busky. Maybe I've read it.
It was about the AFCO farmer who was – there it is, found it. It was on the Saturday Herald, because it was on the back page. That's why I couldn't find it. Right. Well, tying in exactly to that article from the Weekend Herald, Fez forestry will smother New Zealand meat industry. AFCO warns the threat of regions as land use shifts to cut stock numbers. So, you know, that $2 trillion that you were talking about for very little cause – this is the butterfly effect. This is the real effect, is what's happening to farmers. And the concerns that they have here, as a major player in the 10 billion plus New Zealand meat export industry, is predicting the loss of hundreds of meat processing jobs and plant closures from next year due to shrinking livestock numbers. The main culprit? Land use change, particularly to forestry, for carbon emission cost offsetting combined with red tape, high farm costs and volatile market returns. With pressure, a restructure on the industry with too much capacity for tumbling livestock numbers, AFCO National Livestock Manager Tom Young believes. I mean, this argument has been going on, I know, for a long time. Jez Prendon all over this. We are certainly very aware of it here in Hawke's Bay because Hawke's Bay is one of the main culprits. The latest survey and East Coast, the latest survey report by the University of Canterbury shows 73% of exotic afforestation from 2019 to 2023 was in the North Island, with 40% of the total afforestation on the East Coast in Hawke's Bay and the southern eastern North Island. The level of afforestation achieved in 2023, 68,500 hectares, was much less than intention stated in the 2022 survey of 88,000, the report says. Now, with all of that land going into trees. Now, initially, when the trees were starting to be planted way back in the day, and you remember this because I think you planted many of those trees, Martin, they were going into land that had very little value for sheep or beef production. But that's now no longer the case.
Yeah, that was some beautiful land getting planted in trees. And that's against a background of China having, from 1985 to 2023, expanded their forest area from 0.57 to 1.53 million square kilometres. So that's going to come online market-wise about the time that, you know, any trees, forest we've planted. So we're essentially planting our land in pines that are going to have little or no commercial value.
Mm. And the other concern, as well as he mentioned before, is in terms of the jobs losses with the processing plants. There are around 56 beef and lamb processing plants in New Zealand, 34 in the North Island, 22 in the South. The industry directly employs 25,000 people, mainly in regional New Zealand. It's the country's second largest goods exporter, generating more than 16% of all export revenue. Now, those are some really weighty numbers. Most of these plants in regional areas. We've just seen those two Winstone plants close down. They're going to decimate that whole Owakuni, Rarihi, Waiuru area. You and I have seen firsthand what happens when a processing plant or an alpha employer in a regional town closes, what happens to that town. This could be absolutely catastrophic for our regions.
Yep. And again, you can think, oh, they're just foolish. And it becomes rather more sinister when you think it's quite deliberate. They're sabotaging food production. And they're doing it, when I say they, I mean, I always just make it as simple as, well, the people who print the money and their various private equity firms underneath them, they think there's too many people on earth and they want fewer.
Hmm. I just look at stuff like this, and if I ever come across, and it does happen from time to time, where I cross paths with somebody sitting there sipping their rather nice Chardonnay as they've just rocked up into their Tesla and they never have to worry about, you know, shopping around for the best price in butter, then say, oh no, climate change is so real, we need to be concerned about it, this is an existential threat, we must do something. This is the butterfly effect of all of that horseshit.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you're... interview with Williams.
Graham. Back in the day, Graham Williams.
He's one of your first interviews with Graham Williams was so good in terms of just talking about the impact that's having on the coast specifically, which of course is an area dear to both our hearts. But I mean, you know, you get a place like Uawa, Tolaga Bay, used to have something like 13 or 14 rugby teams before the war. I think they've got two now, and they'll be lucky to have one pretty soon. It's just stripped all the people from the land because there's that view that humans aren't part of nature.
Well, it's more than stripping the people from the land. It's stripping the people from New Zealand. And Liam Dann had a little inkling of that in terms of stripping people from New Zealand, because a lot of the ones that are leaving New Zealand, these sorts of workers, they're the workers who in these industries, and they're looking at what they're doing and they're going, okay, if I can't work in the processing plant, if I can't work in the mill, if I can't work in these industries that I have been for years, I will go elsewhere to find work. And where a lot of them are pitching up is Australia, in the mines, in the industries across there, and they're largely getting paid better with better conditions because they're prepared to roll their sleeves up and work hard, and they get rewarded Yeah. Working hard in a way that they don't get rewarded here. So yes, Liam, so it was actually nice really to not have the parroting of monetary policy is working. So it did make a nice change. But he was talking about how boom to bust again, immigration figures have turned dramatically and the economy won't know what's hit it by this time next year. So a lot of our economic growth, and I say growth, like minuscule growth and little in the world's smallest inverted commas, has come from the fact that we have had this immigration that came in. And the immigration came in when the Labor government, who were actually traditionally had been very tight on immigration, had to loosen that a little bit because we had this massive skills shortage after the COVID lockdowns and people, you know, a lot of people had gone. Those who were here, who were immigrants, were like, "Oof, we need to go home. We need to get home fast." And they bailed. Mm. So they brought people in.
Yeah, there were some weird stories about that too. I've got a cousin who works for a building company, you know, quite a large building and building maintenance company in Gisborne, and he was telling me that the owners hired a whole lot of Filipino staff. And it turned out they were pretty useless. And then it turned out they were getting paid more than all the workers who were pretty good because that was a condition of bringing them in. They had to be framed as being high skilled, but they were sort of bums on seats.
Because you're right, there are a lot of Filipino workers, particularly I do know in Gisborne. So brother was running a construction firm and he was the project manager in charge of rebuilding Gisborne Airport. And when the coalition government were in charge and Shane Jones, you know, had his provincial growth fund, had all that money that he was, you know, spreading love with, he went to go and visit the project. It was close to finishing in Gisborne. And I think there was some PGF money that went towards that. And so my brother was showing Shane around and I rang him and I said, "Oh, how was your day with Uncle Shane, Stu?" He said, "Oh, yeah, good." And he said to me, Shane looked around and pretty much most of the crew that were working were Filipino. And he said to my brother, "Oh, Stuart, not a lot of brothers on the work side here, man. We're all away." And Stuart just looked at him and said, "Well, if you can get them to turn up and pass a drug test, Shane, I'll take them."
Yeah. And then, well, that's, you know, again, unintended consequences, isn't it? Liam Dan closes the article. This article kind of is the dark flip side of his monetary policy is working thing, because what he wants to squash inflation is rising unemployment. And he said it before, so now he's twisting his hair into pigtails and going, "Oh, unemployment." But the end of it is basically the equivalent, the Paul Spoonley equivalent of monetary theory is working. There's no question we need immigration, isn't there? There's no question. The total fertility has been below the replacement of 2.1 births per woman since 2013. Maybe we could bring it up. But a path of slow, steady population growth should be the goal if we hope to follow a similar path for economic growth. So, yeah, that's Paul Spoonley's line that he's been trotting out for decades and decades, that and calling anyone who questions it a racist or far right.
Did you see how the teachers are now really upset because not enough kids are going into teaching? And there's a massive training shortage of teachers. And I'm just sort of wondering, you know, this is, where do we get that balance? I'm not a mathematician. I should actually give these numbers to Mr. Marie because he's doing advanced mathematics with his degree. Because I had a look at the birth rate. We now know it's currently 1.52. It's fallen off a cliff. In 2020, it was 1.9. And as he said, 2.1 was 2013. So if it was in 2020, 1.9, and it's now 1.5, babies aren't being born. So if the babies aren't being born, that means the kids aren't going to be coming through the schooling system. So primary schooling, first, early childhood is going to get hit first. So then will we see a swathe of early childhood centres struggling and looking at closing because there are just literally not enough little tamariki running around for them to look after? And then that's going to hit the primary sector. And then, of course, that's going to hit the secondary sector. So, you know, is it necessarily a bad thing that we aren't getting as many teachers coming through?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty dark thing to contemplate, isn't it?
Isn't it?
And also, I mean, why has our population growth fallen off a cliff so badly, how much of that's to do with the fact kids do think the world's about to incinerate, falsely, as it turns out, how much of it is because the old safe and effective that was perfectly safe for pregnant women, even though it had been tested on 20 pregnant mice. I mean, so many questions.
Who knows? So many questions. So many questions. Actually, did you clock the Care Kids survey that came out this week?
No.
Okay, so I only caught so this is another story, visuals. No. I was listening to this, as I am often apt to do, when I was having a shower. So I had the radio going, and I was not listening to us, because it was early, very early in the morning, so it was before we started. And I was listening to another station, and they were talking about the Care Kids survey. And in the Care Kids survey, they were raising a red flag because more children are being hospitalised for what is considered preventable illnesses. So things like RSV and respiratory illnesses and the like. Now, obviously, Jacinda's, Minister of Child Poverty was bust because a lot of these are social issues that can be drawn back to living conditions and the like. The director of the organisation that did the survey was asked, how do we address this? And she brought up the concerns that obviously Māori and Polynesian children or Pacifica children are more adversely affected than other children, and we needed more targeted support for those children. Again, without asking all those other questions, all those other demographic questions, we're just left alone. Let's just apply the race lens across this. When pushed, is there a way to show that we can do this effectively, even if it is based on race? What she cited as the success story that can be done is how they rolled out to that specific vulnerable Māori and Pacifica group in children was the COVID vaccination rollout, again, to children, the COVID vaccination, and the high numbers achieved when you had a targeted effort to ensure that that group, Māori and Pacifica, vaccinated against COVID with absolutely no irony whatsoever at the increased rates of sickness, illness, hospitalizations, and respiratory diseases.
Fascinating. Yeah, it turns out if you put old people on buses and go and guilt trip young people, come on, get your lack of informed consent. Yeah. Why have informed consent when you can use guilt and shame?
Indeed.
Maybe so
I did find that rather interesting. Bruce Cottrell, he always makes me feel a little bit better. Bruce, and I know that you will cover this probably in Fourth Estate, I would suggest, tomorrow. Bruce Cottrell took a little swipe at TVNZ and the legacy media as a main, and I did find that quite delicious. Did you clock that?
Well, that's the great thing about having him writing, isn't it? You can read something, unlike Liam Dan, who doesn't know much at all about economics, according to Rob McCulloch, and only talks to bank economists generally. You can read someone talk about industry who says, I once had the privilege of leading a media business. We were losing millions when I arrived, and we were making millions when I left almost 6 years later. So, yeah, it's good to hear from someone who knows what they're talking about. I mean, we can talk about Len Brown's thing after this as well. Carry on.
So Bruce Cottrell, of course, in the Weekend Herald, quality is at the heart of TVNZ's chief challenges, trustworthy and relevant content central to turning the financial tide. So there's your hint in the subheading. Trustworthy and relevant content central to turning the financial tide. And you hinted to it before, he has run a media organisation, so this is a topic near and dear to his heart. Turning around such businesses is a tough proposition. Sure, you have to cut some costs, but you also have to drop unprofitable business units. But most of all, you have to change the attitudes of your viewers and advertisers. And you can only do that by continuously improving the quality of your output. If we're being honest, the quality of TVNZ's content is worse than it's ever been. As I've said in this column before, every media organisation needs an anchor and a free-to-air TV, and that anchor, and I think he's meaning as in a thing, not a person, That anchor is the need to dominate news, sport and current affairs. These three services are the hub around which the TV channel builds the audience and the advertising base. Through no fault of its own, TVNZ lost control of sport a couple of decades ago. Its current affairs platform, once the domain of in-depth analysis by the likes of Ian Fraser, Brian Edwards and Paul Holmes, no longer exists. Despite the need for high-quality local and international current affairs content being greater than ever, the news hour is no longer worthy of the time it takes to watch it. If the comedy isn't funny and the news isn't newsworthy and the sport is on another channel, we're not going to stick around to watch wannabe famous people trying to survive on an island, cops chasing dropkicks on the Gold Coast, or yet another cooking show. Zing. Ow.
Oh, yeah. And later on he says, many in the mainstream media and TVNZ in particular lost the trust of many of us with the way our response to COVID-19 was stage managed. That came at a time when we needed government accountability more than ever. TVNZ needs to earn that trust back. We have a massive problem with misinformation in the world today. Many of us are desperately seeking trusted sources of news and current affairs. If only we had a safe place to go to find out what's really going on. That's the opportunity, and properly managed, the distribution channels become ubiquitous. I don't think they're not doing it because they don't know that that's the case.
No.
As Peter Williams said on the Fourth Estate last, quoted some executive at TVNZ saying, who are the most important people in television? And I said, well, the audience, I suppose. And he said, no, the advertisers. So this echoes that dawning understanding I had about that the reason they tolerate such terrible ratios, people who hate them, don't do anything about it, is because their customers are the advertisers.
Several years ago, I won, would you believe, on a television competition, the ability to go to a marketing trends conference in Auckland. So, and it was quite an expensive thing to go to. And anyway, I put in a thing and won it to go. One of the keynote speakers at that conference was a media trends analyst from the United States. And he was talking about the shift on away from linear TV to subscription-based streaming and or cable services. And he said television, if in the traditional format, so not digital sign-in, but the traditional format, relies primarily to watch live sports. He said sport is the one thing that people will drop everything and sit around a screen to watch in real time. Without it, in linear television, you do not have a prospect to hold eyeballs to screens.
Mm.
And TVNZ losing a lot of that sports content across to Sky those decades ago was probably the death nail that started the spiral downward. So how do you actually get those viewers back to linear TV? Well, it's certainly not news is the other thing. So it
how do you get car drivers back to the horse and cart?
Yeah. I know. Yeah. So it's Jodie O'Donnell has got a really big job in front of her to fix this.
Well, yeah.
You don't want it fixed. I can tell, Martin, you don't want
it. I do, yeah, as I said, it's a natural progression of things away from linear media. And, yeah, it's the reason that we're all so concerned about it is that politicians have got a vested interest in not pissing journalists off, and so they pander to them. You know, you can make a much better argument that attention would be better directed at things that actually earn us export dollars rather than things that just churn division.
Funny you should say that. In Kiwi Farm yesterday, I had Lenny Ben giving Winky Lux a bit of a woodshed chat and telling him that he needed to go out and do what he was good at, and that was selling New Zealand to the world and not worrying about what all those sheep were saying.
Yeah. No, that's... Yeah, I've been thinking about that Maoism thing, and I've been thinking about that fostering of division thing and what needs to happen. I've been impatient with that chessboard checkered black and white kind of thing. And I've also been very interested in the number of pedophiles turning up in the news. Ozzy Malcolm, P. Diddy has been jailed. We've got
Hugh Edwards, I think, in the United Kingdom.
Hugh Edwards,
child pornography. Another one.
And he's not been jailed, whereas people who liked Facebook posts have. And that's the really tough thing to get your head around, is that the people involved here, it's not necessarily just like someone like Jimmy Savile is a pedophile. He's a procurer. This is one of the most awful red pills to swallow, is it suits the fat controllers to have people in charge who you can wave a DVD at and go, So, you know, a lot of what P. Diddy did was aimed at getting incriminating evidence to have things go the way he wanted. And I'm sure that, you know, prominent newsreaders, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that a good many of them are caused to say things that they know aren't true in a very convincing manner because of the consequences threatened. Ozzie Malcolm, again, one must ask, is the government, successive government's reluctance to confront the abuse in care a result of the fact that so many politicians had been controlled by being given the opportunity to abuse some vulnerable children, as many of those children alleged in their evidence, which is harrowing to read.
I've got an interview that's coming up in the coming weeks that is talking to a documentary maker that touches on that, and that will definitely be a must listen. And that actually kind of dovetails slightly into a column that I never thought I would actually have some agreement with, and that was Harry Tam.
Yeah.
Wrote a column. Now, Harry, of course, is a lifelong member of the mongrel mob. He was also rolled out during the COVID campaign to pop up to Northland to try and increase jab rates through, I'm thinking, his consulting company, because he had that in his byline as well. What I agree with Harry Tam over is the tweaking, the milking of mice, the attempted clumsy finessing that they have currently on this gang patch bill. And recidivist offenders, they're now saying that they can't even wear these patches within their own home. Now, I have openly stated, and I know some of you don't agree with me, I've openly stated that I think that the gang patch ban is ridiculous, and I think it's dangerous, and I think it sets a precedent it's the top of a slippery slope for many of us.
I'd agree with you on that. I think they should enforce firearms rules, enforce driving bans and traffic rules, and trespass a few antisocial people from public areas.
Yeah. So, and the reason for that, and for me, it is a freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and a Bill of Rights issue. And all of us that sit in the mandate space know what it feels like when your rights are breached. The difficulty is if you actually entrench a law like this, what then constitutes a gang patch for another government if we ended up with another government like we did in 2020?
I was reading where he wrote, the potential for overreach and overzealous policing is a genuine threat with this amendment, and it's ludicrous it was proposed a mere month after the Prime Minister's heartfelt speech to victims of state abuse. Around 80 to 90% of gang members suffered systemic abuse in youth institutions. And I was reading part of that, and I was thinking about all the firearms license holders who are getting visits from the police for, again, social media posts. But that harm suffered in youth institutions is real. I've spoken with many gang members who older ones, who trace that back and look back. Well, I was doing okay, did something silly, and then suddenly I've got this blot on my copybook forever. And I've written a few letters to get a few mongrel mob members' dogs out of dog pounds. There is a bit of milking mice there, and I think it glosses over the tremendous ugly harm that's done to society by gangs.
Mm.
But the gang patch thing is, it seemed an odd way to get police to feel that they were doing something that maybe wasn't the most important thing.
Indeed. Yeah, it just, yeah, it just the time, just the police time that would be wasted on that. And I know some people say, oh, yes, but that would, you know, it's intimidating. And look, I'd much rather the police do what they've just done with the Comancheros and actually arrest them for proper, for realsies crimes than be worrying about whether or not that they were wearing gang patches.
Yeah, and there is the barn door. I mean, how long would it be and in what context would a Voices for Freedom t-shirt get caught in that particular legislation? So, yeah, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Right, before we disappear, we did get a really neat piece of little feedback. I have to let you know. Did you see that one from Stuart?
Yes, I did. I'm just trying to...
It says, to Media Matters, this show is like a delicious treat and I save it each week so I can savour it intently and fully. Simply the best coverage of media content and analysis of the landscape that there is. Thanks, Stuart. Oh, Stuart, you made us blush. Thank you that you like it so much.
Awesome. Please enjoy it, Stuart.
Yeah, we really do love the fact that you enjoy it so much. And then there was another one that was in regards to the clip around the Paris Accords that you came up from the listener, and it, from Eve, and countries turned up to the Paris Accord and went, yeah, nah, not for us. Yet stupid Five Eyes countries went in, boots and all, to follow the class model like good wee soldiers. Then let's sell it to the industry and have it jumped on the bandwagon to hitch their products to. Going to be a big fall. Yeah, Eve, I totally agree with you there. And if you haven't caught that little clip, that was from Media Matters a couple of weeks ago. And the best thing about that clip is it's on video and it immortalizes the mullet before it got shaved off.
Oh, yeah. It's taken me a bit of time to get used to being like the little hobbit putting the ring on and suddenly the eye of Sauron can see him. You know, if you look at those first, in my sort of coasty homespun woolen jerseys and, my hair kind of looking like I'm a crazy person.
Well, time has gotten away on us, as it always does. You, of course, are back with the Fourth Estate tomorrow, which is great news. And it looks like I've just got a wee text there from Bonnie. I've got a funny feeling you and I could be pitching up on the political panel as well.
Yeah, we're on the overexposure.
I know, lots of Marie and Marty to go around this week. So if you like anything that you've heard today, or if you've got some thoughts about what Marty and I have discussed, send us a text, 2057 is the text number, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. We love to hear from you. All right, my friend, we'll do it all again next week.
Talk soon, and if we don't catch you, have a great week.
All right, take care, everybody. And remember, if you missed breakfast this morning with Paul Brennan, we do it all again coming up next here on Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.